Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the meeting to order of the Property and Local Tax Division. It did occur to the chair, the House convenes at 5:30 tonight, which is usually the time that we adjourn. So I would like to get everyone through who's got bill presentations, particularly those who have anyone from out of town. Real people from out of town always rank above the rest of us. But Ms. Dalton has kind of a little geek fest for us here, which actually is a value for the committee to understand some of the information that is available to us and new ways to present that information. So, Ms. Dalton, to the new city clusters, if you would.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research, and sitting next to me is one of our research assistants from House Research, Sean Williams, who did a lot of the work on this. For those who have been around for a while, you know that when House Research does printouts on local government aid or any other thing that relates to cities, we don't do it on a county by county or an alphabetical basis. We actually group cities by type and present it that way, mainly because we think it really helps policymakers kind of analyze different legislative proposals, and it gives them a shorthand. There's 854 cities in this state, so it's really hard to talk about 854 cities individually. House Research has been using cluster analysis to, or these cluster groups, to display LGA since 1987. We update these groups about every 8 years. It's been 9 years since the last update, which occurred in 2004.
Ms. Dalton, speaking of updates, we have quorum. Committee is now convened. Thank you.
I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail. You do have a memo in your, a two-sided memo in your packet, which answers some really basic questions. Basically, we group cities based on four characteristics. These are the same ones that were used in 2004. We're just going to do a really brief overview of what the new groups are, because starting today, anything that you see from me is going to be coming out based on these new groups. The other thing you have, without all the red writing on it, is a printout. It tells you, it has summary information on each of the groups, and it also has one page for each of the clusters or groups, and you can actually see the lists of cities that are in those groups. But we're going to go through this really quickly. We used to have six groups for Twin Cities metro area groupings. We now have seven, and we're going to talk about the seven of them very quickly, just give you an overview of what they are. First one is Center Cities. This is not going to be surprising, Minneapolis-St. Paul. We just choose to do them separately all the time. They are 3 to 4 times bigger than any other city in the state. They have very unique needs. They serve very unique populations. We just make them their own cluster, you know, before we even really start the analysis. The remaining six groups in the metro area really share, you know, come out of the analysis, and they share common characteristics. The first group that we're going to talk about is established cities. These are kind of like what we used to call old cities. They are medium size. They're, you know, in the 20 to 40,000 population range. They are essentially not growing. They are fully, basically think of them as fully developed cities that aren't super huge. Examples are Mounds View, Hopkins, Little Canada. The next group of cities are large cities. These cities all have a population over 45,000. Most of these cities used to be classified as diversified cities. They have a pretty high commercial industrial tax base, higher than the norm. So think of these as large cities with a lot of commercial industrial. They tend to have 15 to 25% of their tax base is commercial industrial. Their growth rates are kind of mixed. Examples are Eden Prairie, Plymouth, Coon Rapids, Bloomington. The fourth group are fast-growing suburbs, and as you notice, if you're looking at this map, they tend to be kind of on the outside edge of the metropolitan area. Every city in this group grew by 45% or more in the last 10 years. So these are really fast-developing communities. Most of them tend to be small. 10 out of the 15 have populations below 10,000, which is a really small city for the metropolitan area. They are kind of average household income, you know, in the 65,000 to 90,000 range. And they have kind of average commercial industrial. But what really drives them is these are the fast-growing suburbs. The next, you know, examples are Waconia, Farmington, Belleville. The next group is the growing high-income suburbs. This was the hardest group to actually kind of come up with a name that describes them. They are very similar to the fast-growing suburbs, with one exception. They aren't growing quite as fast. Many of them used to be in the fast-growing suburb cluster, done in 2004, but they've finally reached a point where their growth rates have slowed down. Instead of being 45 plus, they tend to be in the 20 to 40% growth rates over the last 10 years. So they're still developing, but they are much more developed than the fast-growing suburbs. And they tend to be on the northern edge of the city, much more than the southern edge. As you notice on the map, the previous map showed a lot of them being in the southern part of the metro. This group tends to be in the northern part of the metro. They tend not to be growing quite as fast. Group six. The next group is the high-income suburbs. I'm actually going to see if we can, maybe this is as close as you can get. High-income suburbs have extremely high household incomes. It is more than one standard deviation above the norm. He's nodding, so I'm thinking I'm right. These tend to be pretty small cities, and if you take a look at them, and he can click on some of the things so you can see what names, virtually all of these cities are on lakes, or the river. They tend to be on water. Isn't that surprising? There's 23 cities in this group. And finally, the last group in the metro area are the small residential cities. They are smaller cities. All of them have a population under 2,500. Most have a population under 10,000. They are, previously, they used to be categorized as either smaller cities or older cities in the last cluster analysis. They tend to have slightly lower than average median household income. They tend to be in the 50 to 60,000 range, whereas the median household income for all cities in the metro area is about 75. Three cities used to be high growth cities. They're pretty much now developed, and so now they've moved into this group. The one thing I wanted to point out is that there were a couple of cities that had extremely high growth that we actually took out of the analysis. Every time if we included them in the analysis, those three cities would always form their own group because their growth rate was so high, and they're listed at the bottom of this page. Carver, Elko, Newmarket, and Mayer, they had growth rates of 200 to 400% in 10 years. So we took them out and then just shoved them back into the high growth rate cluster at the end. Because, let's face it, a cluster of three cities generally isn't terribly interesting. And then the other thing that we did is we took out the cities. This analysis looked at only the cities between 500 and above. And so there are very few cities with a population under 500 in the metro area. So after we finished the metro analysis, we literally just went back in and assigned those cities to one of the clusters based on whether they had a whole lot of commercial industrial or whether they had really high household incomes. So those cities that are listed on the very bottom of this this page were assigned kind of after the fact based on their biggest outline characteristics. So then we have eight clusters now in Greater Minnesota. This one's actually more fun to look at from the map point of view. We used to have seven, so we've added one cluster now to this one. We'll start with the very first one, and that is what are called the major cities. These are Minneapolis. This is Duluth, St. Cloud, and Rochester. We've always had a major city group. Up until now, we have also included Moorhead and Mankato in that group, but we've been assigning Moorhead and Mankato to that group kind of after the fact. They are really much more like other regional centers, and so this time around, we just finally said, okay, fine. They really are regional centers. They aren't major cities. They just aren't of the size that the other three are. So those two have now moved into the regional center group. What?
That's all right. Continue, Ms. Dalton.
Okay. The second group is the regional center group. This group is a pretty stable group. Virtually every city that was in this group 8 years ago is still in this group. And Mankato and Moorhead, who should have been in regional centers last time around, are in this group. So this group, you know, basically they have very high population, they have high commercial industrial, they have average income, and they tend not to be growing. These tend to be the developed regional centers in outside Minnesota. And, you know, as you can see, they're kind of spread out across the state. They're closer together in the southern part of the state because that's where more of the population is, so you have more regional centers. We'll move to the next. Sub-regional centers. These are very similar to the regional centers. They actually have a higher commercial industrial property base per capita than the regional centers. These are really kind of the jobs centers in outstate Minnesota. They are much smaller, however, than the regional centers. They're, and I should actually know this, they're regional centers tend to be right around 20,000 population. The sub-regional centers average about 3,000 population. And Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, you are right. There is a substantial group of them in the center of the state that are right around the lakes region, and they tend to be high tourism areas as well. The next two groups I want to talk about a little bit together. They are the urban fringe and the high growth cities. And I don't know that he can have both showing up. Originally, there were two groups of high growth cities. And one was a little higher growth than the other, but not quite. And when we mapped them, they tended to be interspersed. And one of the things that we decided to do kind of post is to say, you know, these cities are very similar, but a lot of them are inner ring. They're exurban communities around the seven county metro area, and the rest of them tend to be like fast growing development around regional centers. And so what we did is we did a secondary analysis where we took all the cities in those two groups, put them together, and essentially added a fifth factor in determining them. So the only way you could end up in the urban fringe is if you were located in the county contiguous to the seven county metro area. Not every city in those collar counties ended up in this group. but most of them did, with three exceptions. And as you can see, this is really kind of the exurban area. Then the remainder of that group became what are called the new high-growth suburbs, or high-growth cities. They tend to be suburbs of Rochester, suburbs of St. Cloud. One of the things that's interesting is there's a lot of places in between St. Cloud and the Twin Cities, and we actually looked at how some of these split, and the cities that tend to have more jobs going into the metro area ended up in the urban fringe, and the ones who really primarily have more people going to work in St. Cloud ended up in this high-growth community. One of the things you will notice is virtually all of these places are on major roads. They have access to the regional centers quickly, for jobs. The next group is residential communities. They tend to be, again, kind of surrounding the Seven County metro area and St. Cloud and Rochester. These are tend to be, think of them almost as bedroom communities for those, for St. Cloud, Rochester, people willing to drive a little further into the metro. And then, as you can see, we also have some that are up right around Duluth, some up right around Fargo. You have one next to Grand Rapids. So really think of these as the bedroom communities for the regional centers. They tend not to have the big thing that differentiates them from some of the high growth areas around there is they tend not to have any commercial and industrial property. They really tend to be bedroom communities. Finally, the next group. These are, as you can see, they're kind of scattered all over. These are the rural communities in outstate Minnesota. They are small. They have low population growth. They have low median household. They have very little commercial industrial. This is really what we think of when we think of rural towns and cities. These are the cities that we're kind of thinking of for them. And then finally, the last group of cities, and there are so many of them, they get their own map. These are the cities in greater Minnesota cities with a population under 500, and we have a lot of them. We have 345 out of the 854 cities fall into this group. They also tend to be very similar to the rural cities, except they're even smaller. So these are the groups of cities that we will be using to present LGA and other city-based analysis going forward.
Ms. Dalton, are these cool, fun maps available to the members in public?
Mr. Chair, I have just talked to our web person, and I believe we are going to be able to put the links to these maps onto our website, and so people can go in, and you can go in and click and see which cities are, you can look at the maps and say, what's that city out there that's in this group? So, yes, we will hopefully have them up in the next day or so.
Excellent. And then this cluster work is advisory. These are not classifications that you actually use in creating formulas or things like that. Is that correct, Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. One of the things that my memo says is cluster analysis is as much art as science. We talked a little bit about some of the cities that we chose to move or we chose to keep out of the analysis and then put into a group after. And we do that because, I mean, these groups are only as useful as they make some sense to you. As I said, a group of three small cities with really high growth rate in the metro area, they're unique. They are clearly a group in and of themselves, but it's not a real useful group for analysis purposes when you're talking about designing LGA.
All right. Any questions from Ms. Dalton from members? Thank you very much. Fun. And Mr. Williams, thank you for your help. Because of our shortened time, today, and out of respect for folks who've traveled some distance, I'm going to bounce around on the agenda a little bit. I'd like to start, I think this might be the furthest, yeah, I'm not sure, but we're going to start with non-committee members. Representative Murphy. Out of respect for her. Representative Faust, would you like to move House File 905 be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report?
Yes, I would, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Faust, would you also like to move the H905A1 amendment?
I was hoping I would get the chance to do that as well.
Awesome. Representative Murphy, the A1 amendment is your amendment to get the bill in the order you prefer? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, it's recommended by Ms. Dalton.
All right.
And she can help explain the need.
Ms. Dalton?
We don't have a copy of it.
Oh, thank you.
Do I have a copy of it? I don't have a copy of it. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the amendment is just to clarify that the approval that is being talked about in paragraph B, lines 2.4 to 2.7, is really the resolution and filing that is required in subdivision A. And it's also clarifying that when it says the city has to approve, what that means is that they are passing a resolution and then filing with the Secretary of State.
So, Ms. Dalton, this would require a vote by the City Council. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct.
Thank you very much. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Murphy, to your bill as amended.
Thank you very much. This was brought to me by request of the Proctor City Council, and City Councilor Jake Benson is with me and can talk about the need. And Councilor Benson is the owner and the publisher of the Proctor Journal, and he is past president of the Chamber of Commerce and now is on the chamber, and he's a member of the Lions, and he's a activist.
Councilmember Benson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Jake Benson, Mr. Chair, members, as Representative Murphy said, I am a city councilor. I own three businesses in Proctor, served on the Chamber of Commerce for two terms, and I am a former member. And I do thank you for the opportunity to hear this important bill for Proctor. Proctor's slightly more than 3 square miles, slightly more than 3,000 residents. We're bisected by I-35 and Highway 2. We're right outside of city of Duluth. And we're bordered on three sides by two cities that have at least a 1% sales tax already in place. Proctor was created to serve the mining industry. At the time, we were the largest iron ore sorting facilities in the world. Almost 29% of all the developed land in Proctor is owned by the Canadian National Railway, which cuts our community in half with its railroad yards and presents some unique safety concerns. The railroad pays very little property taxes, much lower than commercial and residential. And recently, the railroad neglected to block one of its train cars. It rolled across the crossing, railroad crossing, on our main thoroughfare that connects our east side to the west side of town, ran into a vehicle, pushed it down the street with someone in it, and Proctor lost its quiet zone because of that. No, the whistle blows every hour on the hour because the railroad is very, very busy, and it's great for those who like to hear the sound of a railroad whistle, great for those who grew up in the community, but not so good if you're trying to sleep. It's going to cost the city of Proctor $250,000 to create another quiet zone because of the railroad's negligence, and it's the taxpayers, not the railroad, who will have to pay for it. Because, again, the property taxes the railroad pays is a fraction of what everybody else does. Most recently, we lost our canine officer, our animal control officer, our school resource officer, a park worker, our office staffer. Our infrastructure is strained, old. Our city administrator, a lifelong Proctor resident with an MBA, understood the problem of what's going on in the city. He would have liked to have been here this afternoon. He apologizes for not. He was called out of state. But he works for $14,000 a year. Our old city administrator had close to $100,000. And like I said, our infrastructure was failing and strained as it was, and because of those June floods that occurred up in the Proctor Duluth area, it just wiped out a lot of it, and we're still trying to put it back together. This bill is important to us. It's going to keep us on the equal footing with our two neighboring cities, and it has no fiscal impact to the state. And we will be able to pay off our bonds a lot quicker. So thank you. I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Councilmember Benson. Ms. Dalton, can you review for the committee this request and contrast it with at least, shall we say, custom and usage in terms of local sales taxes, just to review for the committee?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this isn't expanding what they may use it for. They have a fairly, the city of Proctor has a fairly extensive list of uses that were allowed under the 2008 and 2010 bill, including a lot of the sidewalk and trails and sewer infrastructure. Basically, this bill is doing two things. One is increasing the rate, allowing them to increase their rate to 1% to continue to pay for these same projects. The normal rate for local sales taxes tends to be half a cent. However, Hermantown, I believe, also has a 1%. So that's the city that's sitting right next to Proctor. So at least it's comparable to, you know, what's going on around it. And the other thing is, the second part of this is, all local governments have to basically file with the Secretary of State for a special law if they want to approve that, they acknowledge that they want this special authority. And unfortunately, the city did not do that for either their 2008 or 2010. They didn't do the filing with the Secretary of State, so this is retroactively letting them go and fix that mistake.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to make sure, so at the end of the day, will you have a half cent or a 1 cent percent? A half a percent.
Councilmember
or
Benson.
Percent?
Councilmember Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the end of the day, we hope to have that 1%. When we had the original sales tax election, it passed by an 11-to-1 margin. So our citizens know that this is something we need, and they've approved it wholeheartedly. I think we had over close to 800 people who voted in that election.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 905? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps just a question of the councilman. I see that part of what you're funding is a civic center, community center, recreation, that kind of thing. It's a small city, and I just wondered how the folks feel about having their own civic center.
Councilmember Benson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, when we first built that, it was designed to be multi-use. So not only is it a civic center, it houses our police department, our city hall. The school utilizes part of it. It's got some operating kitchens. And it is in full use 7 days a week from the time those doors open up until after 10 o'clock at night. It has achieved every wish and dream that we had. And it actually is now suffering a little bit because of all the use. We're in the process of buying new tables and chairs because it does get used extensively.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Councilman, can you tell us how much was raised in this last year by this half cent or half percent sales tax?
Councilmember Benson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, We raised approximately close to $158,000.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair. So, Councilman, is it because of tourists that you're able to generate this kind of income from your half percent?
Councilmember Benson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that was going to be part of, I think, a second piece. But, yes, we have an extensive tourist industry, thankfully, because we're close to the city of Duluth. We did implement a lodging tax 10 years ago. We were one of the last in the state to go from 1 to 3, and we use it for marketing and promotions. And, you know, through that, we have at least 115,000 people spending a night in town using our facilities. Approximately 77,000 rooms a year get booked, which also puts a strain on the infrastructure and public safety.
All right. Thank you, Councilmember Benson. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Torkelson. Question for the GOP lead.
Yes. I thought I had a question, but I...
No, I have a question this time. We're kind of trading places here. Representative Murphy and I spoke late this afternoon. I had did not realize when we scheduled HF 905 for a hearing that Representative Murphy also has HF 904, and Councilmember Benson is the testifier for that as well. We're trying to be respectful of his time and not ask him to come back when we hear House File 904. So I'm wondering if it would be acceptable to you that we not hear 904. We have not posted it. We cannot hear it. But that we allow Councilmember Benson to briefly cover his testimony related to House File 904, and we can all file it in our memories for when we actually hear the bill.
That would be fine, Mr. Chair, but in this case, I have to ask a question because you called out my name, and I feel I need to ask a question of the testifier.
I guess that's just a fair trade in one moment. Would you please distribute HF 904? This just, again, we're not hearing the bill, but I figured it made more sense to talk about the bill with the bill in front of folks. And Representative Murphy will have the pleasure of visiting the committee another time.
We all love common sense, Mr. Chair.
I'm glad we can agree on what's common sense today. Representative Torkelson, final question on House File 905 then?
I'm curious about the county fair. I understand you have two county fairs in your county, and I was the author of a bill that sent some legacy money to county fairs. I'd like to hear about how it went.
Councilmember Benson.
Interestingly enough, Mr. Chair, Representative, I do have coffee virtually every morning with the president of the South St. Louis County Fair, and they're enthusiastic. They can't wait to put those legacy funds to use. I think they're building like an outdoor pavilion or gazebo, something large enough to hold nice events. St. Louis County isn't unique. Not only do they have the Hibbing Fair, and also the South St. Louis County Fair in Proctor, but they have the Southwest County Fair in Floodwood, which I know because I also own the newspaper there as well. But yeah, the fairgrounds get a lot of activity. Most recently, it was in the city of Duluth, and the city of Duluth was gracious enough to cede it to the city of Proctor. Now we work very closely with the South St. Louis County Fair Association to ensure that, you know, there's a lot of activity going on.
Thank you, Councilman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd suggest you contact your local representative and express your enthusiasm.
I will do that. Thank you very much.
Councilmember Benson, question from the chair. Is there a North St. Louis County Fair?
Yes.
There is? All right. Good enough. Enough said. then House Representative Faust does his motion again. I don't have my language for... Did you want to say more about House File 905? I'm sorry, Representative Murphy.
I just wanted to say something to Representative Torkelson in that I was a supporter of Representative Torkelson and the importance of legacy funds at county fairs and how much it could mean to the youth and the elders at the fair. And I think that's an appropriate use of the legislative office.
Excellent.
Any last comments on House File 905, Representative Murphy?
No more.
Excellent. With that, Representative Faust renews his motion that House File 905 be held over for possible inclusion in the division report. House File 904 is not officially before the committee, but we did want to give Councilmember Benson the opportunity to not drive south again soon. Representative Murphy, do you have anything you want to say, or do you want to save your powder, keep your powder dry until the full hearing?
For next week, Mr. Chair, but the Bill 904 would allow Proctor to authorizes a food and beverage tax for the city of Proctor.
Ms. Dalton, do you want to just review the bill briefly for members?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it, as Representative Murphy says, it allows a food and beverage tax and an entertainment tax by ordinance, which is pretty common for these types of taxes. It's not been a common practice to require a local approval vote on them. The use of the proceeds is for a number of capital costs, but also for operational costs of the Proctor Regional Center and to deal with some festival and event coordination costs. Again, that is not unusual with the food and beverage and the entertainment taxes. Those have been allowed in the past to be used for ongoing operations as opposed to strictly for capital, unlike regular sales tax.
Ms. Dalton, on 2.2 to 2.5, where they talk about the festival and event coordination, it specifically includes police and security services. Is those specific expenses normal? I think of those as city general fund expenses.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've not seen police and security services specifically enumerated in any of these in the past. However, some of the civic centers, when we've talked operations costs, clearly those operations costs would include security.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, I guess. First one is, would this allow or would this impose then a tax on like high school football games, baseball games, hockey games, since it says sporting events, or would those not be included in that?
Councilmember Benson, why don't we do this? Why don't we let you say what you want to say first, and then you can answer Representative Faust's question, however you want to do it, but give you your shot.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, committee members. I certainly appreciate the courtesy you have extended me, and I'm still Jake Benson.
Thank you.
And I own one of the three businesses in Proctor that I do own is a travel agency, and I do serve as the head of our tourism board in Proctor. Proctor, for the past 40 years, has been the entrance to the Duluth Spirit Mountain Recreation Area, and 80 acres of Spirit Mountain, the most valuable property in Proctor, is owned by the city of Duluth, yet they pay no taxes, yet we have to provide services. And for the last 92 years, Proctor has been the entrance to the South St. Louis County Fair, which also is very busy week after week during the summer. An estimated 76,650 rooms are booked every year in Proctor at one of our three hotels, with about 115,000 visitors who spend the night throughout the year. They go to our equine facility, our half-mile dirt racetrack, our regional recreation center, our gun club, our nine-hole golf course, Lake Superior, and Duluth. They go to events that begin in Proctor, like the Blizzard ALS fundraiser, which is the largest snowmobile fundraiser of its type in the United States, and this year it raised $850,000. The MS-150 is the longest and largest bicycle fundraiser in Minnesota. That begins in Proctor. Last year there was close to 7,000 people who camped out on the school grounds before the start of the race. Amsoil Snowcross snowmobile race brings 35,000 people to town. That starts in Proctor, and they're headquartered there. We have a lodging tax since 2002, and last year we became one of the final few cities in the state that raised it from 1 to 3%. And this food and beverage tax would just help us improve on all of that. And, of course, with all the visitors, quite successful, puts the strain on it, but this will be able to do more things with our fairgrounds and all these wonderful centers that we have for activities and events.
All right. Thank you, Councilmember Benson. Councilmember Benson, is the Red Roof Inn in Proctor?
They changed their name. Now it's the America Best.
All right, but they didn't change where they are.
They are still there.
All right. Representative Faust, if you'd repeat your question or questions for the council member.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My first question is that if we are allowing or, I guess, putting the sales tax on sporting events, does that mean that high school sporting events are also taxed?
Council member.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Ms. Dalton could probably weigh in on this. Probably knows the law better than I. I don't think you could tax high school sporting events, nor is it the intention of the city of Proctor to tax high school sporting events.
Ms. Dalton, to the tax exemption of the high school league.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the tax exemption for the Minnesota State High School League is only for the general sales tax. This allows the city to define by resolution what the entertainment event is. You could certainly clarify it to say it can't be this. You could put some limits on that if that was the wish of the committee.
Right. Representative Faust, thank you, Ms. Dalton. Representative Faust, another question?
Yes. How are your property tax rates compared to other communities your size across the state? Higher, lower, about the middle, where are they at?
Councilmember Benson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. We would like to think we're in the middle. I think our tax extension rate is higher. We certified a levy of slightly more than $1 million on a $3 million budget. Probably 47-48% of our local, 48% of our revenues come from local government aid.
Representative Faust? All right. Any other questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Councilman, if I were to come to Proctor to enjoy your city, and I do think you have a beautiful city, how much would I pay in total tax based on what we're reading here? And
doesn't Representative Erickson, doesn't that have to do with how much you drink? It is a food and beverage tax.
No, I want to know in percentage, what's it going to be? Because the lodging tax is 3%, correct? So then what will it all add up to?
Well,
Councilmember Benson.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative. Certainly a lot less than the city of Duluth. having said that.
Okay, you've sold me on staying in Proctor.
Yeah. Well, you would take the current state tax,
yes,
and you'd add 3% for the lodging. Our beverages are very reasonable, at $3.50 a piece, so you would add on another 1% to that.
Mm-hmm. And then if I go to an event?
So
another percent?
Like a races are $10 approximately for the cheap seats.
Okay.
All right.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. I figured it out.
All right. Any other questions for the council member? With that, sir, thank you very much. Have a safe drive back.
Thank you all very much.
Continuing with the non-members of the committee from Greater Minnesota, Representative Radinovich, if you'd please come forward. Representative Lean, would you like to move House File 747 to be before the committee for possible inclusion?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lean. Representative Radinovich, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm here today with Bill number 747, and it deals with referendum market value and exemptions for referendums related to seasonal property. And so just a kind of a brief primer on this bill. I'm from Crosby, Ironton. Right now, 48% of our school district is seasonal property. And so when we go out to pass an excess levy referendum to, you know, fill in the hole that is school funding and the lack of school funding as related to expenses rising. We have a real difficulty because 48% of our tax base we aren't able to access through that levy referendum. And so what it means is, in a community where 60% of the students are on free or reduced lunch, or 59% this year, that burden falls disproportionately on those families. And I view this as not an issue of, you know, one side versus another, but an issue of making these districts whole and allowing them to support their schools locally with the totality of their tax base. And, you know, just to give you an idea, you know, some of the disparities that this causes, many of us are familiar with education equity.
Schools for Equity and Education.
There we go. And so, you know, one of their big points is that, you know, one of the primary drivers between the inequity in funding statewide is the disparity in property tax bases from school district to school district. And so if you were to try and pass an excess operating levy in, say, Minnetonka or one of the western suburbs, to meet the maximum levy on a $100,000 home, it would cost you an average of about maybe $130. And by comparison, if you were to look at communities like, say, Royalton, which is on the high end, for a $100,000 home, in order to raise the maximum student levy at about $1,600, they'd have to put on an extra $515 in property taxes. And so this bill narrowly addresses those districts that are impacted because of their high seasonal recreation ratio. It doesn't fix the problem for every district statewide in the inequity in education, but it could certainly help a lot of them. And so I want to introduce Deb Wanick. She's from Pelican Rapids. It's one of the districts, you know, that we feel is adversely impacted by the arrangement as it currently stands, and I'll let her speak to sort of what their experience in Pelican Rapids is.
Thank you, Representative Radinovich. Ms. Wanick, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Deb Wanick. I'm superintendent of the Pelican Rapids School District, and I really appreciate this opportunity to share our story with you. We have a district in northern Minnesota, Midwest Minnesota, that's a little bit different in that we have 30% of children of minority because of a turkey plant. We have 50% free and reduced. We have about 18% ESL. If you allow me a 15-second analogy, right now the federal government is trying to balance their budget. If in that scenario and they were balancing and they had a tax and it was incidental, but it took 50% of the tax base away from Minnesota, and it was the wealthiest 50%, and you were left with the lowest 50% to run your state, it would be very, very hard. And that's exactly what happened in 2001 when the seasonal rec was taken off. And so for us, when we go to pass a levy or try to pass a levy, we have 50% of our school is 50% free and reduced, and so we have a very poor population carrying that burden. Right now, we have...
If the page could assist, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Our county auditor put together some information. We have a $100,000 home, and with current law, with the referendum market value is $159 on that $100,000 home. If this were to pass, that would drop to $68. We were able to pass a referendum after four tries. That referendum is on this base, and if you look at the seasonal rec, they right now, $100,000 home would pay $121 to the state. If they were to go to this change and be put on the referendum market value, that would drop to $68. So that is, again, a significant drop in the tax that they would have to pay, and it would certainly support and help us as we're trying to move forward and providing the education. Right now, we are in the midst of looking at a renovation bond for a building. We have part of our building is built in 1928, so we're certainly struggling with some of those pieces and looking at that renovation bond. And if this law were to pass and we were to pass that referendum, the taxes would still go down from what they are now. So it truly is a significant impact on our district.
All right. Thank you, Superintendent Wanick. Is there Representative Radinovich?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do know there are some other testifiers who would like to speak to the bill. Certainly, you know, whenever you want me to answer questions or be available, I can. So it's your show to run. But I know there are some other people that would like to speak to the bill as well.
Thank you. My intent was to open it to further public testimony and then come back to member questions at that time. So I don't even have to ask. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair, members. My name is Snezhana Besanov, and I'm here on behalf of Minnesota School Boards Association, and we represent about 22,000 locally elected school board members across the state. And first of all, I'd like to thank Representative Radinovich for bringing forward this proposal. MSBA does support House File 747, as it aligns well with the Delegate Assembly Resolution, which MSBA has passed. It says that MSBA urges the legislature to eliminate seasonal recreational exemption from voter-approved operating levy funding. Since the elimination of the general education levy, Minnesota schools have become increasingly dependent on the local property tax for funding. About 90% of the districts have an operating levy. The exclusion of the seasonal residential recreational properties from the referendum market tax value is an unfair burden on homeowners and students in the districts that have a higher proportion of seasonal rec properties. And the taxes paid by seasonal rec properties are collected by the state, and then they're distributed to pay for various projects that the state is doing. MSBA believes that those dollars should go directly towards the local communities. In addition, oftentimes areas with high concentration of seasonal rec properties also have a high concentration of state and federal lands, which makes it more expensive for homeowners and more difficult to pass local levies. And so MSBA supports equity in funding for all Minnesota students and asks for committee support in this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Hasbargen, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
I'm Renee Hasbargen, representing the Minnesota Rural Education Association. And I think the arguments have been made well for why this is an important bill to rural schools. I will say that the 33 districts that don't have operating levies at this time are primarily in districts like the one that Superintendent Wanick described. And we do have 50 districts in all that don't have an operating levy or have one underneath $300 per pupil. And they are distinctly great disadvantage in that the last 10, 12 years after we did the removal of seasonal rec and ag property out of our property tax base in the great 2001 reform, we have relied more and more on operating levies to fund our schools. So this is a basic question of fairness for the students in those districts. We're hopeful, and I'll say this because we have many members of the K-12 committee at the table, we are really hopeful that we can have a more comprehensive property tax reform piece that affects school levies and school bond issues this year. In the absence of a comprehensive reform, this bill is an important first step, and a sort of an emergency step for the students in these districts who have been so disadvantaged. So the MREA and our 150 school district members strongly support this bill and your efforts to get more fairness for school funding. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hasbergen. Mr. Forrester, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with the testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Forrester, and I represent Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates, so people who we have a lot of cabin owners as members. Thanks for hearing this bill. In 2001, when this first came up, this trade-off of the excess operating levies and the state general tax, we were told that a portion of the state general tax would go into an educational reserve fund so that we would actually be paying into the local districts where our cabins were located. That changed the following year, and it was all made part of the general fund. Many seasonal property owners live in the districts where their cabins or hunting lands are located. Many have strong ties to the local communities where their cabins or hunting lands are located. So we understand the problem local school districts are having. Since 2001, we have often erroneously been held out as a straw man, people claiming that cabins don't pay school taxes. And this is not true. And I'm not sure that adding another class of property to the tax base does not guarantee passage of proposed referendum. The real issue here is an over-reliance on referendum levies as a result of declining state commitments to local school districts. We recognize the need for a solution, House File 747, along with many other bills being considered for school funding mechanisms, are all pieces of a rather complex puzzle. And frankly, we are not entirely clear on what the final result will be in terms of people's actual property tax bills or the amount of funding provided for each student in these districts by the state. That is why we welcome the discussion here today. We look forward to working with the members of this committee and the various bill authors as these bills move through the process. And thank you for giving us time to speak.
Thank you. Mr. Forrester, what's, in your understanding, the relationship between education funding and local government aid funding?
I'm not sure what you mean.
What's the relationship, let's say, to the between the statewide business and seasonal rec property tax and local government aid?
I am not sure how much of the state general tax would go into local government aid. I mean, it's part of the general fund, I think, is where the state general, where the business tax goes, business property tax.
All right. Thank you, sir. Mr. Vanosik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rob Vanosik on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. I want to thank the author for bringing this bill forward. This is a change we've sought for many, many years, and also was a recommendation out of the property tax work group, whose report you heard earlier this year. We strongly support this bill. It does make the property tax system much more understandable, equitable, justifiable to property taxpayers, and also makes the property tax system more accountable. It treats properties equitably, and a house is treated as a house, and we want to thank the committee for its consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Vanosik. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 747? Seeing none, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I had a question for the first testifier.
Superintendent Wanick?
Superintendent.
If you'd please return to the table.
And I guess she's coming down. I can ask the question. She was talking about it's going to lower the property taxes on the homes in the district. How's this going to affect the property taxes on the seasonal recreational property that's there now? Is that just going to be the burden going to be shifted to those people?
Superintendent Wanick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you look at the front of the sheet that has the children on it, the numbers at the bottom on the far right are the seasonal recreational, and our county auditor put this together that currently they pay to the state $121 on a $100,000 home. It's not the referendum value, it's what that goes to the state. And then if they were to be put on as referendum market value, then they would drop the $121 and it would drop to $68.
Okay. Representative Nelson?
That answers the question I have.
All right. Any other questions from members? Mr. Hines? Let's go here first.
Yeah. That's who I wanted to hear from.
Well, there we go.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson and Erickson, I just would reference you to, I did include in your packets a House Research short subject on, which gives a little brief summary of the class rates and which taxes they're subject to on the front page. And then on the back page, it does have a table showing what the tax is on a $200,000 property, depending on which classification it is. And this, to do this exercise, we just picked a very average set of tax rates, and of course those do vary from locality to locality. This shows that if you look at the cabin in the kind of the middle of the page, you'll see that the taxes on that $200,000 cabin are about $2,309. The next line down, residential non-homestead, would be treated exactly the way cabins are under this bill. So you could look at that tax as $2,360. Interestingly, reflects about a shift in the other direction. But partly that's to emphasize that it does really make a difference as to what the referendum rate is. And, of course, what it is now versus what it would be under this proposal is a variable. But I guess this was just to give you a flavor that it could indeed go either direction depending upon the referendum rate and the state rates, and even the value of the property, it varies a little bit, but I thought that might help.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Representative Radinovich, do you have more to?
I don't have any more to add to that.
Representative Torkelson, you have a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Radinovich, so there's, if I'm understanding this correctly, there'll be a significant reduction to state revenues. How do you propose to fill that hole?
Representative Radinovich.
Well, so the way I understand this is that the general levy that we're talking about, 95% of that is made up of commercial and industrial classification, and 5% is made up of seasonal property. If you take seasonal property out of that and left the levy amount where it was, then the additional 5% burden would be dispersed over the rest of the classifications in that levy. Now, what ours does is it writes down the amount on the state general levy by about $40 million, which is the 5% that represents. And so, I mean, this certainly comes with a price tag, but any investment in education does, and I think that this is an issue of fairness. And so what you're doing is you're leveraging that $40 million at the state to put these local districts back in a position where they have the ability to levy the dollars in their own community to supplement where, you know, the state hasn't kept up, in my opinion, with education and funding over the last decade.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is going to make it even harder for the state to keep up with that funding, isn't it?
Representative Radinovich.
I'm someone who believes that we'll need additional revenue to keep up with our obligations for education. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair, but you're giving us less revenue.
Right, but I assume, well, I don't assume anything here. I've been here eight weeks, and I've learned enough not to do that. But, I understand that there, our potential revenue increases in the forecast, or at least in the coming months.
All right.
And Mr. Chair, I have one
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The voice of the cabin owners in a levy referendum vote, what voice will they have?
Well, they won't have any. Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, and you know, just as a commercial property owner doesn't have any voice in another district, if there was a referendum vote or an industrial, I think that our system of voting is predicated on your residence, and you know, in this case, if you own a property of any classification in a different district, you don't get a vote in that district, and you know, obviously, that has implications here, but so does taking away 50% of the tax base in these school districts.
Representative Torkelson.
I'm done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Radinovich, have you polled your seasonal rec owners?
Representative Radinovich.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, no, I have not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Garofalo. Well, last question.
It's my first question.
I know, but it's our last question.
Oh, I understand.
The first shall be last, and the last shall be first.
I will. Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, I was up in my office listening to the committee hearing, and I heard my friend Representative Radinovich come down with a bill, which is the Bermuda Triangle of legislation, comes out with property tax changes, education funding, and reducing revenue to the state in the form of a reduction. My first jokingly question would be to you is that, who did you make mad in the DFL caucus that let you carry this bill to this committee? But, Mr. Chairman, Representative Radinovich, this is his first time to this committee, isn't it right, Mr. Chairman?
I believe that's correct, Representative Garofalo.
So, Mr.
I think he's blushing, Representative Garofalo.
Did the member from Aiken County bring treats for this committee?
To that point, Mr. Chair, I think there was a problem in my committee with something too.
But so, Representative Mahoney, is there a pattern of behavior emerging here?
I'd have to vote yes on that.
We might need to send him to the superintendent's office. And luckily, we've got one.
So I did have a serious question, though, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
As I look at this and my knowledge of. My knowledge of referendum market value is limited because I used to chair the Education Finance Committee. And and so the my question is, we see that the reduction in non-commercial industrial property tax levy, that over the biennium, that's going to be reduced by about $65 million. I've just reviewed this quickly. What would be the amount of the property tax increase, or I guess the fair term would be, how much of the property tax would be distributed to seasonal rec properties? So what are we netting out at?
Representative Garofalo, if I understand your question, I believe that was covered earlier.
I did not hear that on the. Well, I was. Okay,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Radinovich,
Representative Garofalo. If I understand your question correctly, you're saying that if we take the seasonal property out of the state general levy, that 5% that it makes up, the remaining 95% of classifications left in that levy will have to make up the burden. What is that? Is that what you're asking?
And Mr. First of all, my apologies. I think I when I left my room and came down here, I missed the question. But so just I want to make sure I ask the same question that was asked before and you can give me the same answer. Is that, number one, there's going to be a property tax. There's going to be a tax reduction because we're taking this money out. That's going to be a $65 million reduction over the next 2 years. The question is that when we take seasonal rec property and put that onto the referendum market value property tax classification, there's going to be a shifting of property tax revenue to those homeowners. Do we have an approximation for what that amount is? I understand that net the property taxes aren't going to be going up. We're just taking an existing tax base and we're expanding it into new frontiers. Do we have an approximation of what that dollar amount is?
Representative Garofalo, we've got two documents. One, Superintendent Wanick brought that was where the numbers come from the county auditor. And then nonpartisan staff has a short subject here where if you go to the back, they provide a hypothetical scenario. And they lead you in different directions. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, I did not attempt to do the run that you would to determine that answer, and I don't believe the Department of Revenue did either. Yeah. But it's even if you did, if you ran the current referendum rates on the seasonal rec property, you know, there's no guarantee that the answer you'd get would be the same with this in place because it would change the dynamics of referendum levies. But that's kind of a smokescreen to say we didn't actually do that run. I'm guessing, though, that it's going to be somewhat similar because, as the chairman has alluded to, their analysis and Proctor showed that come out a little lower. This example I use shows them coming out higher. So I think it's in the same ballpark, but I haven't done it.
Okay, and then
Representative Garofalo, briefly, please.
Yep, on the fiscal note, the final point is it says there would be additional school referendum levy equalization aid impacts. Is it correct to say then that this policy would incentivize districts to go out for additional levies?
Mr. Hines.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, I think it's probably safe to say that by giving them this added tax base, there would be a bit of an incentive to go to pass referendums, indeed ones that have been struggling to pass them in the past. They would hope this would increase their odds, so you might say that. But it would also cause a little lowering of equalization aid on the referendum side, and again, that's another piece you'd have to factor in that hasn't been factored into this analysis yet.
And okay, and just Mr. Chairman, I was pointed out to me point number two here, the combined effect of referendum and state levy changes, a non-commercial seasonal recreational property is a decrease of $25.3 million. So that was on there. I just didn't read it. So, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate it, and my apologies for being late.
No problem. Representative Radinovich, any brief closing comments?
Brief closing comments. I'd just like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the rest of the committee for giving us the opportunity to hear this bill. Again, you know, I support some comments that were made earlier by Mr. Forrester about the state's role in education and the reliance on levies. I think that that's moving in the wrong direction. It's contributed to the disparity in resources between school districts, but in the absence of a more comprehensive solution, this is the type of legislation that could put a lot of districts in my area and in the Lakes area in general back in a position to levy their own district for the resources they need. So I appreciate your consideration, and I'm sorry I didn't bring treats.
All right. Thank you. Representative Radinovich. With that, Representative Lean renews his motion that House File 747 be held over for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Lean, you're up, shifting to Greater Minnesota, but on the committee, and reminding the committee that the House convenes at 5:30, and the chair's brother is doing the prayer. I should be there on time. You've got an election certificate as well, Representative Mahoney. You make your own decisions. Representative Lean moves that House File 515 be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Lean,
thank
do
you,
your
Mr.
bill,
Chair.
Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And this House File 515 is the appropriation for the Border City Development and Border City Enterprise Zone. Basically, what this appropriation is for five cities along the border, western border, Minnesota and the Dakotas, East Grand Forks, Moorhead, Dilworth, Breckenridge, and Ortonville, to take care of some disparities between the business climate between the Dakotas and Minnesota. And I've said it before, and I really can't say it enough as I've been down here, how crucial it is for us to really think about and focus on these programs, not just for my district and the districts that these cities lie in, but really for all of western Minnesota, northwest Minnesota. Real briefly, a little bit about the programs themselves. They are tax credits that DEED administers, and they allocate it on a per capita basis to these five communities from their businesses in the communities, apply for, through the cities for the program or for the dollars. And the dollars specifically go to sales tax exemptions for materials for business expansion, credits for new employers, debt financing for expanded facilities, to draw down property taxes for newer expanded commercial industrial facilities, workers' compensation insurance, property tax exemptions, as I mentioned, and some cities also use it for new manufacturing businesses. With that, I will turn it over to the Moorhead City Manager, Michael Redlinger, to talk a little bit about specifically how Moorhead utilizes the program.
Is it Redlinger?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Redlinger, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Michael Redlinger, Moorhead City Manager, and thank you for your time this evening. I'll be brief in my comments. As the members of the division know well, the border disparities are heating up along the border of, with North Dakota, and our work today on the border city matter is just as relevant as it was back in the mid-1980s when some of these disparities started to emerge along our border. And so with North Dakota's oil well starting to heat up, it's perhaps even more important, even more critical today that the state assist the communities along the border, East Grand Forks, Breckenridge, Moorhead, et cetera, in maintaining this competitiveness. This is really about the efficient delivery of credits, as Representative Lean said, and some incentives for Minnesota businesses to not only stay in Minnesota, but to grow and expand within Minnesota. So this is a real key retention program for Moorhead, for Breckenridge, for East Grand Forks, Dilworth, et cetera. And at this time, in Moorhead alone, out of our participating businesses, which is going to be 237 businesses annually, but about 150 businesses anticipated for participation in 2012, we're getting down to the very end of our funding. We actually only have about $60,000 after the 2012 allocations are made to these businesses. So it's just real important that we support these businesses and incent them to stay in Minnesota and keep their jobs in Minnesota. And the $2 million funding request is authored by Representative Lean will certainly support and stabilize these businesses. So with that, appreciate Representative Lean and the committee's time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Redlinger. Representative Lean, you have another guest.
I do. Mr. Bruce Beckeris, he is a business owner in Moorhead, and he'd like to talk a little bit about, kind of on the ground level, how he has benefited from this program.
Beckeris. Mr. Beckeris, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Bruce Beckeris, thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee. I own A1 Automotive and Transmission Service in Moorhead for over 60 years. We strive to grow our business in Moorhead and be successful in Minnesota. We've participated in the Enterprise Zone credit for several years, and this program helps our business offset our workman compensation costs. So it makes us be more competitive so that we can survive with our neighboring state with the cost of employment. We're optimistic that this program can continue, and the Moorhead businesses definitely appreciate what's been done in the past, keeping these funds for us to help us offset the cost of workman compensation in the comparison to our neighbors.
All right. Thank you, sir. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 515? Representative Marcourt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much, Representative Lean, for bringing this forward. Members, I cannot impress enough, as the three gentlemen just did there, of trying to keep a level playing field between North Dakota and Minnesota, especially along that border. Unlike being next to Wisconsin has similar kind of tax structures we do, North Dakota is an anomaly, especially with the revenues they're bringing in. I think they're reserves right now is like $2 billion, and they're one-eighth the population of Minnesota, so that equates to $16 billion of surplus. But as this article shows, too, they are looking at vastly reducing property taxes to the tune of $766 million. Now, just to put that in perspective, let's say they don't do that. Let's say they just do $500 million. Times that by eight in comparison, it's like Minnesota providing a $4 billion property tax relief. And the governor's offer, $1.5 billion. And we think that's pretty huge. This would be $4 billion. And the property taxes have been one of the benefits we've had along that border. And so anything we can do to level the playing field is going to be vitally important. And we've had this border city program for a number of years in the area, and thank the legislature and governors who have supported that in the past. But I'll tell you, the need has become much more acute with the economic fortunes of North Dakota right now with the oil and what they can do with that money and its property tax relief. And so, members, this is important to the quality of life for businesses, but also for residences and, ultimately other areas in northwest Minnesota along the border. So thank you all for being here today, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in light of your wanting to get over to the House floor, I'll just have a quick one. This is, I understand it, a one-time appropriation, and it sounds like with the testimony this is a continuing problem. So what does that mean when the request is for a one-time appropriation versus a continuing need?
Representative Lean, to Representative Carlson's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, that is certainly one of my major concerns as well. The last time this program was appropriated, I believe, was 2008, and that was for just over $700,000. So taking that into context and taking into account what North Dakota has been doing as far as their oil revenue, I fully agree that I would like to see, well, of course, I would like to see more expansion for my district, but also for all of northwest Minnesota, that this is certainly an ongoing issue, an issue that will be ongoing for 20 years. And, you know, this one-time appropriation is certainly a start, a step in the right direction. But, I certainly would like to see more ways we can help out commerce and economy in northwest Minnesota.
As one who
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, as one who asked to watch Tales, I probably shouldn't have asked the question. but I can see the oil revenue just continuing to flow in North Dakota, and I can see that you've got a long time.
I do appreciate that, Representative Carlson.
Representative Garofalo, again, your position of last question.
There you go. Mr. Chairman, that's what 2 points. Number one, I want to take this opportunity to remind the committee about my idea for the Slant Oil Drill Company in Moorhead. Go over to North Dakota and take their oil out. It's a perfect economic development solution. But a serious question, Representative. The case you've made regarding North Dakota, their incredible natural resources, I mean, haven't you kind of made the case for why we should not be raising taxes on businesses in Minnesota?
Representative Lean.
That is certainly a good, thank you, Mr. Chair. That is certainly a good point, Representative Garofalo. And, you know, aside from the discussion of the budget and tax proposals and things, I think this is a way we can look at the problem in a very acute basis by looking at these areas up and down the border with Minnesota, Dakota, and really take advantage of all action we can take to keep those business climates healthy.
Any last question or comment, Representative Lean, in closing? You got it? All right. Gentlemen, thank you for traveling down. Safe travels back. With that, members, we stand adjourned.